3:09 on News Talk Radio 580 CFRA. And hi, I'm Rob Snow. Great to be with you on this Wednesday afternoon. It's the healthiest hour on radio. Dr. Barry Dworkin is here taking any and all health-related questions. And the numbers to call, 521-TALK. That's 521-8255. Star 580 is a free phone call if you're on Bell Mobility, and a free long-distance call as well. It's 1-800-580-CFRA. 1-800-580-2372. Great to see you.
Good to see you,
and
too.
And lots of phone lines available right now, folks. Encourage you to call early because things tend to fill up as we make our way through the hour. I want to get your take now. We're about a dozen days into the federal election campaign. The Globe and Mail brings it up today. Not much talk about health care and the future of health care, but what have you thought of the either lack of debate or the debate thereof surrounding health care in the federal election campaign?
Well, you could literally hear a pin drop with regards to the amount of noise being made with regards to health care. And it is, when you think about it, Rob, look at the size of provincial budgets for health. You talk about this yesterday. You're talking
42
about
the, cents. Talking 42 about the cents of every dollar.
The e-health fiasco and the money that was wasted just on that. And 40 cents, and likely to go up to 50 cents on the dollar in the next 10 years, and then even more thereafter.
Well, C.D. Howe, the Institute, is over the big study today, for example, and says you take all the money, and this for 1 year, all the money spent by the federal government on health-related programs, and then all the other jurisdictions spent on health. 1 year, $192 billion. And one of the authors of that report, who's David Dodge, former governor of the Bank of Canada, said totally unsustainable, universal health care. But, you know, try to find a politician who's going to say that, right?
It is a death knell topic.
Because, sacred cow.
Because you cannot, exactly, you cannot have a rational discussion in this country about our healthcare system, because anytime any new idea is just proposed, not enacted, not saying we're going to do this, but rather let's look at another way of potentially improving availability, improving the means of which we deliver the services by looking at other countries that have universal coverage, that have a different way of doing it, and yet their populations are being provided with better services, shorter wait times, and trying to incorporate what is being done in other areas of the world that seem to work and incorporate that into what we have here. Instead, we have any mention of looking at changes, anything that goes astray from the direction that we've been going in over and over and over again, and you end up with ad hominem attacks. You have people criticizing the person as opposed to discussing the idea, and it never gets past that.
Right. You get painted as an ideologue or someone who's in favor of privatizing healthcare. So, dirty words.
Right. So if you have in an election campaign where you do have potential for complex issues to be discussed. And if you start to bring that up, what happens is someone will jump on one specific area and flog it to death and use it as a bludgeon instead of having a discussion.
I mean, I don't want to come off as hyper-partisan. I think people know my political leanings. But I just find these new Democrat ads on healthcare, they're just totally juvenile and facile with these, cardboard cutout Stephen Harper's, Tim Hortons healthcare. That one hospital in the province of Ontario, I think, had to, because of overcrowding, move into the part of the cafeteria.
Right. Ignoring the fact that it's provincial jurisdiction.
A provincial jurisdiction, $1 billion squandered on e-health, but it's Harper's, Tim Hortons healthcare kind of thing.
The proposals that come out all the time is throw more money at it, over and over and over again, and the results that you get are the same results.
Nothing changes. For example, today, Jack Layton says, we're going to make home care and long-term care wholly covered by the Canada Health Act, to bring that into the universal healthcare system. So I guess if you need a doctor to come visit you at home or a nurse to come visit you at home, right now most of that is you pay out of your own pocket for things like that.
Well, for physicians to go to the home is covered by OHIP.
Right.
Nurses, CCAC care, for example, community care access centers are covered.
All right.
But there are limits. So if you need 24-hour care, 7 days a week, you're unlikely to get that at home. You likely would have to go to a long-term care center.
Right.
But the point
he says
is,
he'll make home care and long-term care insured by services by adding them to the Canada Health Act.
Well, you can wave a magic wand and say you want to do that, but the question is, how do you do that with the limited resources that you have? So are we going to say we're going to tax everybody at 80% so that we can cover all the costs? You might be able to do that. You have to get the personnel. You have to determine in your system what are the priorities for care. Is it, as it was intentioned, to minimize the debilitating and disastrous effects both from a social, financial, and family perspective where being critically ill results in literally the destruction of your family and your work and your financial wherewithal? That's what you need a system to be able to protect you from. In this system, we have people using a system where, for the most part, the services that they're asking for are not expensive. And so you look at other countries where people who are in, say, between 20 and 40 years of age, not a huge group compared to our demographics now, but nevertheless still constitute a lot of money being spent on that group, and look at countries and how they handle that. You have people in the United States too, they're looking at doing this now to say where, you will be given the opportunity to purchase insurance to cover certain care so that people, the elderly, dementias, home care, languishing in hospitals where it's not doing them any good, that's where the bulk of the expenses are going to have to go. And we have to say to ourselves, what are we going to give up in order to do that? Because you can't do everything for everyone, and it hasn't even come to that discussion yet.
Dr. Barry Dworkin is with us. If you have any comments on what he has said so far or any other health-related questions, he's here for the hour, folks. 521-TALK, star 580, or 1-800-580-CFRA. We'll get to your phone call shortly. Dr. Barry Dworkin is here for the Wednesday House Call on 580 CFRA. Melinda, you're up first with Dr. Dworkin. Go ahead.
Hi, Dr. Dworkin.
Hi.
I just have a quick question. I went to a chiropractor for a low back issue mm-hmm. that I was having, some pain, which was resolved. But in the course of having some x-rays done, he was quite concerned, apparently, about the curvature in my neck at the top of my spine.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, it's curved the wrong way. It goes completely in the other way. And I'm wondering how concerned I should be, if I should be going to my family doctor or if this is really a concern.
Now, whenever this comes up, I have to tell you, Melinda, Dr. Dworkin has a very skeptical look on his face right now.
I'm going to be brutally frank, Melinda,
okay.
with regards to x-rays that chiropractors do, and it's probably going to get me lots of flack. But nevertheless, I have yet to see any x-ray done by a chiropractor that doesn't come back to say something is out of line or out of adjustment or misaligned on the x-ray, especially since a lot of the x-rays are done when the person is not positioned properly. The curvature in the neck, which is called the lordosis of the neck,
okay.
Usually is a C shape, right? It's sort of the neck goes inwards towards your throat. That's the curvature. If your neck was curved completely the other way, your head would be bobbing forward with an inability to flex your head.
She'd
or
be
extend
like
your head.
A bobblehead.
Yeah, you wouldn't be able to move your head and look upwards. So,
well, I must admit that I'm a very skeptical person
yes.
as well. So when this was told to me, I said, you know what, I've never had any issues with my neck.
Yes.
I'm 39 years
yeah.
old.
And you probably don't.
No, and that was my concern was, I just thought, should I go see my family doctor or is this something that I just need to say, you know what, until there's an issue, that's when I need to have it looked at.
I would agree with the latter part of your assessment
okay.
in that if you're not having any problems with your neck, doing an x-ray, and it actually brings up a broader comment, is that a test is only valuable if it's going to change the management of what you're going to do for someone. And if someone does not have any pain, it has good movement of their neck, the x-ray in itself, despite what it says, means absolutely nothing.
Okay, perfect.
Okay.
All right.
I'm glad to speak to you.
Thanks
glad
for the
you
call.
Called.
That's
Thank
a very
you.
Interesting call.
Okay.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Your spine appears to be backwards.
Okay. It's yeah. don't do tests unless you're going to actually do something with the result or it's going to change something for the better. And that's doing x-rays for the sake of doing x-rays is not helpful for anybody.
521-TALK, star 580, 1-800-580-CFRA. If you have a question for Dr. Barry Dworkin, Margaret.
Hello.
Hello, hi. Margaret. Go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call, Doctor.
You're welcome.
I have strange feelings in my feet.
Yes.
And there's numbness in my feet.
Okay.
And they're hot, and then they get cold. And they really get cold mm-hmm. quite a bit, and quite hot, too. I don't seem to know what to think about it.
Okay. Well, Margaret, how long have you been having this problem?
Oh, I've been having that for, I'm sure, 6 months anyway.
Okay. Now, are there any medical conditions you're being treated for? For example, high blood pressure or blood sugar problems? Or
yes, blood sugar.
Okay.
I am on that metformin.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also in my 85th year.
Okay.
Wow.
And I had to take 4 a day.
Okay. Well, for somebody who is diabetic, getting tingling or numbness in the feet can be related to the blood sugar not being controlled very well, and it causes some damage to the nerves. It's called diabetic neuropathy. And it is something that has to be taken very seriously, because should this continue, you will lose sensation in your feet. And part of the problem is when you start losing sensation, you then have difficulty knowing where your feet are when you're walking. And that leads to falls. And for somebody who is 85 years old, mm-hmm. falling is not a good thing to be doing, because you have a much greater risk of fracturing a hip, mm-hmm. breaking a hip or spine. Mm-hmm. And so what you have to do is you have to tell your doctor that you're getting this numbness in the feet, that it's been about 6 months. It likely means you have to have much better control of the blood sugar. It means likely changing the medications or adding medications on. Also making sure that your blood pressure is very well controlled.
I have good blood pressure.
Well, for diabetes, usually what is considered to be good blood pressure for someone who doesn't have diabetes would actually be too high for someone who does have diabetes. And so it's very important to balance that out. But again, the numbness in the feet, especially in the context of you having diabetes, means that the nerves are being damaged, and the nerves are being damaged because the tiny arteries that go to the nerves to keep the nerves alive are being plugged up. The high blood sugar is causing those arteries to get blocked, and so less blood gets to the nerve, the nerve starts to get affected, and eventually those nerves die. So you want to try to prevent that from happening. You're sort of in a stage where it's starting to happen because you're getting tingling, so you can still feel it. And so you really want to see your physician to try to get that blood sugar to come down even more.
Well, and what direction could I go? I don't know. I've told the doctor about it,
mm-hmm.
but she just seems to not let it bother. She doesn't want.
Then what I would say, Margaret, is you have to tell your physician not to ignore it. You can also ask your physician to send you to the there's a diabetes clinic in Ottawa. It's at the Riverside Hospital, where they can also help you out. I would not take no for an answer or to have this dismissed. Numbness or tingling in your feet is dangerous for you. And it's not something that you should have to continue to experience. And at the least is try to control the blood sugars even better in order to minimize the damage. But this is not something that I would continue to allow to go on for when your physician is saying, well, no, we wouldn't take that seriously. You have to take this seriously, and you have to advocate and say, I want something done.
We seriously have to run. Back with more of your phone calls right after the 3:30 news with Dr. Barry Dworkin on 580 CFRA. .339, 580 CFRA, Dr. Barry Dworkin is here for the Wednesday house call. And let's get right back to the phone lines at 521-TALK. And if you have a health-related question, I encourage you to call as well in this half hour. Faye, you've been waiting a long time. Thank you for your patience. Go ahead.
I just turned you on when you were talking about the health care.
Yes.
And Dr. Dworkin, do you think it's ever possible to have enough money for health care?
They do it in Europe. This is the point I was trying to make, is that there are other countries that offer universal, and we have to compare apples to apples, so universal coverage, providing things to their population, but they do things a bit differently. We are consistently in the lower rung of the Western countries, the OECD, about 30 countries. we tend to be always in the lower 20s in terms of ranking when you look at healthcare outcomes, especially with how our system works. And people in other countries are not being taxed to death to support their healthcare systems. The system itself is organized differently, and it usually incorporates a mixture of public services, private services, but the private services are covered by insurance plans that people have to buy. And those that do not have the financial wherewithal to do so, that premium is covered by the government so that they can also have those services. So all I am suggesting is that we look at what other people are doing. When the same thing goes for anything we do in our lives, we always look for examples of how to improve things, how to make things better. In science, it's always experimenting and building things. Engineering, you build things, you learn how things work. If you have a disaster, an earthquake, you know, you build a building that then can withstand that. So it's the same type of approach. Look at what other systems are doing. Look at it from that aspect and say, what are they doing to be able to afford this? What can't they afford? And take it from there and try to incorporate that and at least have a discussion about it. We're not even at that point of even talking about what other people are doing.
Well, I mentioned the C.D. Howe report out today. Yeah. C.D. Howe, a very well-respected public policy think tank. And here's the conclusion from David Dodge, former governor of the Bank of Canada. We face difficult but necessary choices as to how we finance the rising cost of health care. Some combination of the following actions will be necessary. One, a sharp reduction in public services other than health care provided by governments, especially provincial governments. Mm-hmm. If you're going to keep allocating more and more and more to health care, it's going to have to come from somewhere else. Increase taxes to finance the public share of health care spending. That's mm-hmm. another option. You can tax us even more, right? Mm-hmm. We're at 42 cents on the dollar. Maybe we have to go up to 52 cents or 62 cents. Or where does it end?
Mm-hmm.
Number three, increase spending by individuals on health care services that are currently insured by provinces through some form of co-payment mm-hmm. or through delisting of services that are currently publicly financed. In other words, partial privatization, if you will, of mm-hmm. health care. We'll have to pay more out of our own pocket.
Correct.
Or for a major degradation of publicly insured healthcare standards, longer queues, services of poorer quality, and the development of a privately funded system to provide better quality care for those willing to pay for it, as in the UK and many European countries. This two-tier option would not have much effect on the rate of growth of total spending, but like option three above, would alter the public-private split and have distributional implications. None of these options is appealing. There is no easy way to manage the chronic healthcare spending rise.
Yeah, and that's
from the C.D. Howe Institute today.
That's one of many reports that come out. You have healthcare,
and it'll be a doorstop somewhere along.
Yeah, you have healthcare spending is going up 7 to 8% a year. I don't know about anybody else, but I doubt anybody's income is going up 7 to 8% a year to be able to cover that. And certainly government's income is not doing that, although they're spending like that's the case. So, again, it is going to take very difficult yet thoughtful choices to try to ensure that people are protected, that people who end up being severely compromised by illness, who need help in the system, are able to get that help. We don't want to have people catastrophically, literally destroyed by their illnesses. But we have to come up with very difficult decisions, and it's going to mean likely reduction of services in one area that may not cause as much profound difficulty as other areas, which will cause more profound difficulties for people. But we have to at least start to talk about it and not scream and yell at each other about how inhuman we are or how uncaring we are or how somehow profit fits into this, or the usual canards.
It can't
that come
be linked
out every
to patriotism
time.
In some way, just, which it often is. Okay, let's go on and take a call from Brad, who's been waiting a while.
Sure.
Brad, go ahead.
Hi, Dr. Dworkin.
Hi.
I recently been tested positive for community associated MRSA.
Yes.
And what I find strange is that I was feeling fine before. I had an infected elbow, and I was mm-hmm. feeling fine before. And went through all the antibiotics, and one of them didn't work. But anyways, after going through that and feeling better, I was sent to the infectious disease clinic to get tested.
Right.
And was swabbed again there and was tested positive.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering why, like, how that can be possible if, like, I'm feeling completely fine.
Right.
Is it possible that the infection is still in my system, yet is dormant of some sort, or
no? What is happening? MRSA is, as for listeners, is methicillin-resistant Staph aureus. Staph aureus is a normal bacteria that exists on our skin, and under circumstances where it will grow, that is, an injury, getting a laceration of the skin, abrasion, especially
like
for young.
He said he had an injured elbow, for example.
You know, for young individuals who have MRSA, it won't cause infection unless it's given the opportunity or the environment in which to do so. So abrasion of the elbow, lacerations, getting injections, tattoos, injection drug use, anything that breaks the skin gives a chance for this bacteria, which normally resides on the surface of our skin, doing no damage, to get under the skin where it starts to grow because it prefers an environment that doesn't have oxygen. So it's when on our skin, it's suppressed by the oxygen around us, and we have an intact skin layer, which is our defense. These bacteria also help protect us as well. They compete with other microbes. So it's not that it's a bad bacteria because it's a normal constituent on our skin. It's now because it has resistance to particular antibiotics, in this case methicillin or penicillin-type antibiotics, you need to use different antibiotics and sometimes combinations of them, sometimes to eliminate that infection. But all this means is that you carry this bug on your skin, but you don't have any infection. It's just simply the bug that's there, just like everybody else in the world that has Staph aureus on them. This one in particular is resistant to methicillin. But
is there any risk to those that live with me, like wife, daughter?
They likely have this same bacteria on their skin. There's no risk to them. They're young. The risk is if you go, for example, to the hospital and you visit someone who is older or elderly, if they've had surgery, that's where you run the risk of infecting them with this just by touching them, and they can end up with much more severe complications. But in everyday life, in what's going on in the community, even though your skin has methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, you're not going to be Typhoid Mary. You're not going to be giving this out to anybody else or causing them any harm. Again, the only way this causes harm, as with any staph infection, you break the skin, you get the infection. So there's no difference that way. It just simply means a different antibiotic is going to have to be used.
Okay. This will be the last call for Dr. Barry this week. Michael in Cornwall.
Hi, doctor.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
Good, thank you. I have a quick question. I phoned you about a year ago. I had symptoms of a numbness and tingling in my face and tongue area, which I had gone to see a neurologist about.
Right.
And basically, they didn't find anything wrong with me. And the neurologist had said, people in my age bracket, I'm 50 years old now, he has seen people with unexplained circumstances about this. But I don't know if this is related, but I'm a three-season runner. I start in the spring and I finish in the fall. I don't like to run in the winter. I don't want to break an ankle in the ice.
Right.
So I run anywhere between 5 and 10K, and I'm in pretty good shape. But when I run fairly hard or when I'm training, I find at the end of my runs, I get some numbness and tingling now in my fingers, in my hand area, in both hands, not just the left side of my face, which was, like I said, a year and a half ago.
Okay.
I don't know if it's related or not. Do you have any ideas?
It's unlikely to be related because the face and tongue are supplied by, the sensation is supplied by cranial nerves, which are nerves that come off directly from the brain stem or from the brain itself.
And, right. I have had two MRIs, and those are clean. I do have a couple of small spots in the cerebellum.
Right.
That's unrelated.
Right. Whereas tingling in the fingers come from nerves that come out of the cervical spine, which is way below the area of the brain. Usually between the fifth to the seventh cervical vertebrae in that area, those nerves branch off and go into the fingers. Is it all the fingers or thumb, index finger, sort of? Are any fingers spared from the numbness?
I don't remember offhand. I know it's mainly my fingers. I don't remember my thumbs as much, but it's usually the fingertips that end up tingling, yes.
Because the reason I ask is that tingling or numbness in the fingers, because there are three nerves that go to the hand, three branches that go to the hand, each supplying different areas of the hand, knowing which fingers were affected can also isolate the branches of the nerves that may be compressed when you're running.
Right.
The other issue is if it's the entire hand, again, if you think of the main trunk, main nerve coming down into the arm, breaks into three nerves. So if and then those three nerves go down to the hand. If the entire hand is numb, it means that the area that is damaged or potentially damaged has to be up where the branches before it branches off, the main trunk, right? Because the whole hand is affected. If only part of the hand is affected, it means that the damage is likely further on down the arm towards the hand where one of the nerves is being affected. So important to know what's doing that in terms of what area of the hand is affected. And then you have to determine whether it's nerve or whether it's even something we call Raynaud's phenomenon by running outside, whether the arteries that are bringing blood to your hand are constricting more than they're supposed to, and that can also cause that tingling. But your first area of investigation is to map out which fingers, and then when you see your physician, say, these are the fingers that are bothering me, because that's a very important clue to then trace that nerve root and see where it's potentially damaged.
They're hauling us off the stage.
Okay. I know, we got to go.
Thanks for coming in this week.
You're very welcome.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, the Wednesday house call. Don't forget the Sunday house call this weekend, Sundays at 4, and Health Headlines with Dr. Dworkin, just before the 7 o'clock news during Madeley in the Morning.